Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. Wow, a great time in franchising as the Franchise Leadership Conference is going on in Buckhead, Georgia. Looking forward to hearing back from all who attended. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend, just coming back from Denver. But we'll talk about that here in a moment today. And moving forward, as an added feature to the show, I'm happy to welcome my co-producer and writer of the show, Joe Caruso. Joe, how are you today?
Fantastic, Paul. I wanted to change your name there, but I was thinking about one of our guests, and his name popped into my head before your name did. But I do know you're Paul Segretto, and I'm happy to be on the show with you again today.
There you go. Well, I'm happy to have you on the show. And like I said, moving forward, we're going to use this opportunity at the beginning of each show to have Joe and I discuss a few things, go back and forth, banter, and give each other a hard time. But more importantly, kind of give us a general introduction of what to expect for that day's show, as well as future shows. And Joe, today I know we have Ray Hayes, international franchising expert on the show today. If you would give us a little preview of what to expect later on in today's show.
Well, you know, today's show we're going to cover a lot of the concerns that franchisors have about how to address interest from abroad for franchising in other countries. And I don't think there's a franchisor in the United States that doesn't get an email or a fax or a voicemail at 3 o'clock in the morning from Malaysia or India or China about somebody that's going to just loves their brand and wants to take them global. And I think Ray's going to shed some light on, you know, what do you do with those inquiries? Are you really ready to go global? And what's the best way to launch your international franchise program?
Sure, it sounds like an interesting topic, and one, international franchising, that we have spoken little about over the last couple of years as we are now in our third season on Franchise Today. And also, I know we have some riveting shows coming up in the next few weeks. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, I got a really exciting show I'm working on right now, and we just got to confirm the guest, but the American Bar Association Forum on Franchising is happening next week near me here in Baltimore. And we've got a number of folks that are attending, and we're trying to corral one of them into giving us a recap of all the things that they're talking about at the Bar Association Forum on Franchising conference. And that's going to be a good show. We just got to nail down the guest. And then we have Tom Spadia, a good friend of mine, interesting guy. He was a development guy, franchise sales and development guy in franchising for a good many years with franchisors, and he decided to become a franchise attorney. So he went to law school, became a franchise attorney, and he specializes in working with franchisees on lease negotiations and working with franchisors to make sure that the franchisees have someone to go to in order to do their lease review. And he's going to be talking about the nuts and bolts of landlord and lender negotiations and how to set the table for franchisee success. So that's going to be a great show in the end of the month on October 27th. Next week, we're working on a show that you're going to do regarding FranCamp, the conference in Nashville. And, of course, in later November, we have Shelley Sun from Bright Star, and she's going to talk about her new book. And so we've got some really good stuff coming up.
Boy, all of a sudden we're at Thanksgiving and Christmas is right around the corner, and that just seems to be that it seems like it should be just far away. You know, talking about far away, I flew to Denver last week, participated and was a proud sponsor of Franchise Today and Franchise Essentials. We're proud sponsors of Greg Nathan's Franchise Relations Boot Camp, put on by the Profitable Franchise Relationships Institute out of Australia, and I also was at the one in Dallas the week before fabulous event, in my opinion, a must, absolutely should be kind of pre-required for anybody receiving CFE designation, but that, of course, is another question for another day. Just an absolute phenomenal event, both of them, even though I sat through it, you know, twice, 2 days each time. Greg is just a fabulous speaker. If you have an opportunity to listen to him or see him, I highly recommend it. And of course, Joe, we've had him on the show now several times talking about franchise relations and his franchise relations boot camp. And he's just, at least in my opinion, absolutely the best, the leading source for information with respect to franchise relationships.
You know, what I really like about Greg, what he preaches is really very, very simple and essential about having great franchise relations. And, you know, I think that's something that most people want, the franchisors aspire to have, is great relations with their franchisees. They want to be able to communicate with them back and forth. But he tells people practical ways of actually doing it. He tells them how. And there's precious few people out there in franchise consulting. They can tell you what the outcome is, but they can't tell you how to get there. And Greg tells you how to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, a very, very, very well-known expert in international franchise environment and community. And speaking of international franchising, as we know, it's front and center today on Franchise Today. And I do welcome as our guest Ray Hayes, a seasoned international franchise executive and consultant. He has a successful 20-year track record of developing and supporting master franchisees worldwide, including actual field experience, which really impressed me, in 50 countries. He's earned his certified franchise executive designation in 2007, his MBA in 1994. Building upon his Bachelor of Science degree in International Affairs from Georgetown University, he studied within the Spanish and cultural curriculum in Spain at the Universidad de Sevilla. In addition to his international work as a franchise executive and consultant, he has planned and executed trade missions and partner searches with U.S. Commercial Service, U.S. State Department, foreign government agencies, and, of course, the International Franchise Association. Ray, welcome to Franchise Today.
Thank you, Paul. And Joe, great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on, and let's just jump right into it, because as many of us know, there are few things more flattering for franchisors than franchise investors. Beating a path to their door to buy their brand, and when the interest is international, the dream of global domination for your brand can be intoxicating, to say the least. Ray, what's a franchisor to do so they can ensure an effective international launch?
Well, you know, really, before going international, any franchisor just needs to be absolutely sure that they're ready for it. And you know, the first thing is fairly obvious. You have to have strong proof of concept in the domestic market. If you know, if you're still struggling to you know, get all your resources and processes and procedures in place in the U.S., you're not ready to go international. I would say, really, you want to be sure that you are sufficiently staffed. In particular, if you're running on a skeleton crew. You know, and I know a lot of early stage franchisors, or you know, have people who wear many hats, and that's great because you have to you know, you have to be lean and mean in your early years. But if you don't have the staff time to really invest in an international project, don't do it. It's just not right for you. Financial stability, that's another thing. I really don't recommend to a franchisor that that they move forward until they have either, you know, just a solid war chest, solid funding behind them, or if they're bootstrapping it, they should at least be royalty self-sufficient. So if they're still relying on franchise sales to keep them afloat, it's probably not the best time to start looking outside the U.S. for franchise partners. And then finally, and I think most importantly, and I think that many of my international colleagues will agree with this, you have to have commitment from the top. Going international is a strategic decision. There is that sense of, glamour, of infatuation with being a global brand, but it needs to be deeper than that. You really have to sit down at a board level and say, okay, are we ready for this? This is a strategic decision. And if you hear anyone in the group say, well, let's just try it out and see how it goes, don't do it. And especially, at the ownership or CEO level, you need someone to be absolutely behind the initiative before you move forward with it. So I'd say that kind of summarizes, you got to be really ready to go and, dedicated for the long haul.
Sure. And seeing your educational background, which is quite impressive, but, with the focus on international affairs and then, of course, studying within the Spanish and cultural curriculum, having spent 20 years in the international community, being in the field in 50 different countries. I mean, you've got to be 100 years old to get that all into your lifespan, but I don't think you are, which makes it even more impressive. I mean, certainly you've seen a lot, and you've seen a lot of people and organizations go through the trials and tribulations of wanting to jump into that spotlight of being an international brand. But, taking a step back, Ray, and as you said, it needs to be a strategic decision. But do you find that most international launches are actually strategic, or are they really opportunistic?
Well, I really haven't seen any statistics on this. And, I might ask other colleagues of mine across different franchise industries within the franchise sector. But anecdotally, I would say that most franchisors really went into franchising as a reaction to an opportunity that was presented to them. It may be up to 75%. Really were reactive in their first steps internationally.
Certainly not that there's anything wrong with an opportunistic reaction to international franchise requests for expansion. But looking at it from that perspective, where do you see the pitfalls, and how does the intrepid franchisor avoid disaster?
Well, that's a great question. Well, first of all, you're right. Taking advantage of an opportunity is not necessarily the wrong decision. As with any strategic decision, sometimes excellent opportunities come knocking, and you'd be foolish not to take a serious evaluation of that opportunity. What I've found is, especially with franchisors who are new to international, is what I call the fish that jumps in the boat. And you've kind of alluded to that in some of your introduction. You get these calls from India, you get these calls from China or the UK saying, hey, love your brand, I want to take this and roll it out in my country. And too many franchisors, just say, sure, it's going to be, you know, $1 million. You got the money, and, well, let's go. That is the absolute wrong way to do it. And as I often say, the fish that jumps in the boat will start stinking in about 6 months to a year. And then you're going to spend more money extracting yourself from the situation than the revenues that you got going into it, number one. And number two, if it's an important market and you blow it your first time, you're going to have a lot of trouble getting back into the market. You know, really, when you get these opportunities that are presented, you have to, I think the first question is, going back to what I was saying earlier, are you ready to go international? And even if it's the best partner in the world, if your organization is not ready to go international, don't do it, because you're going to fail, and you're going to, again, spend more time and money trying to fix the problem than really succeeding in a strategic sense. The second thing is, you know, again, are the resources in place to support that over the long term? So you may get, let's say you're in, pick an industry. Let's say that you're in the yogurt industry, and you get a company that is just, you know, one of the top leaders in five different top branded concepts in quick service restaurants, QSR. That might be a great and very well qualified partner for you, but again, if you're not ready to live up to their expectations, you are going to be in some trouble pretty quickly, because you can't market yourself into a partnership without having those resources behind you. And then finally, I think, you know, one of the things you need to, of course, do is, you know, have you done your due diligence, number one, on that franchise, that prospect? And if they do, you know, show as being one of the absolute best, you know, players in the market, and they've got the capital resources and lots of other things match up, then, you know, maybe this is the right decision. But also, have you done your due diligence on the country? Is the country, you know, what considerations do you need to make with India, you know, if you're going into India? The interesting observation being, you know, McDonald's, when they went into India, you know, people in India don't eat beef, so kind of limits their menu selection, but they've succeeded because they really took a localized approach to the market. I'd say that all of these things really come into play, and it's funny that you mention the, you know, avoiding disaster, and I think it, you know, you can sit here and preach all you want about, you know, don't just grab any fish that jumps in the boat, but, you know, when you're under a budget, you've got to, you know, hit that mark for a franchise, initial, you know, franchise fee revenues, and you have someone who's ready to stroke a check for six figures, yeah, it's pretty tempting. But on the back end of that, you can really, really shoot yourself in the foot in a major market, and it can be something that will haunt you for decades. And I'll give it a very specific example. I'm not naming any franchisors, but interestingly, in my career, I've had two very similar examples with master franchises gone bad in Japan. And the first one was of particular interest because I came in, this was when I was in the support role, I was a regional director, for Asia. But you know, when I met the master franchisee the first time, something just wasn't right. Something wasn't clicking, and I just sensed that. So I called up one of my Japanese colleagues, a fellow I had known from graduate school, and wanted to get a local perspective. And I said, you know, something's just wrong with this. You know, they're not hitting their numbers. I don't get this. I don't understand why this isn't headed in the right direction. And he said to me, well, Ray, what, you know, tell me a little bit about this guy. I said, well, you know, he's got great capital. You know, he's in the area of a sector of real estate development. He said, stop. He said, I know exactly what the problem is. I said, what? He said, he's a mafia. He's Japanese Yakuza. And I said, well, he says, everyone here in Japan knows if you're in real estate development, you're Yakuza. So I had the pleasure of going in there with the director, or the vice president of operations. You know, we had meetings on where things were going with this master franchise, and basically after, I don't know, 5 years plus, they had sold one franchise. And so once we get back to the States, the VP tells me, well, Ray, what you're going to have to do is go over there and terminate him. Are you kidding me? This guy's Yakuza. So that it was perhaps the most interesting meeting of my life. I will never forget sitting in this restaurant, and number one, and this is another red flag, this master franchise owner did not speak any English, so I had to work through an interpreter, and she was a very, very good interpreter. And basically, I politely laid it out that I'm sorry, we're going to have to terminate the master franchise agreement. And, you know, this was translated, and he nods, and he talks to the interpreter, and she says, well, he's suggesting that perhaps that might not be a good idea. And I said, well, I understand, but, you know, we've made that decision. And basically the same answer comes back, but maybe a little more clarified, such as, you know, really, that's not a good idea. And finally, this, you know, and I kept a straight face, but at this certain point, this interpreter just gets really frustrated, which is unusual for, you know, Japanese. She turns to me and she says, he's trying to intimidate you. Basically, he's trying to threaten you. And I said, oh, I certainly got that. I understand. Thank you very much. But unfortunately, the decision is final, and I've got to go catch my plane now.
You didn't ask for a ride, though, right?
No, I didn't. No. A cab was waiting outside, airport. I was out of there. And I still have both pinkies, I'm happy to say. So
the samurai sword sitting next to the table didn't tip his hand.
No.
You know, it's funny you mention, you know, the analogy of the fish jumping in the boat. And I immediately reflected upon a story that I heard and then saw a video, and I think it might even be one on YouTube. It wouldn't surprise me. Of, you know, somebody just, you know, trolling along in their small boat. And a fish jumps in the boat. And, of course, the fish is like this 15-foot shark. And it's in the boat. And, of course, you know, there's not much room, you know, in the deck area. And he can't even get behind the wheel of his boat with this shark in the boat. So he can't steer. And so it kind of, the analogy kind of goes along with what you were saying. So I'm thinking, okay, great, opportunity. The fish jumps in the boat. In this case, it's a shark. You can't even steer. You can't, you know, move in the direction that you want to go. So what do you have to do? You have to terminate it.
Yeah, exactly.
And somehow or another, you have to terminate this shark that's flopping around in the boat and figure out what to do with them. And so, you know, as you led into the Japanese story, I was chuckling even more to myself, you know, thinking about that fish being a shark in the back of the boat. And certainly I could imagine what you've seen and experienced in across various countries and borders and cultures.
Yeah, and just as a kind of a postscript on that story, the next franchisor that I worked with had the exact same problem. It turned out that their master franchisee in Japan turned out to be mafia. Mm. And during a certain time in Japan, the mafia needed to get rid of their cash, and a lot of them saw buying an American franchise as a way to launder their cash. So, but what I can say about those two franchisors is they tried to get back into the Japanese market. Absolutely, no one would touch them. No one would touch them. So that's a big market to burn. And just because you're not doing your due diligence on, you know, who you're working with.
Absolutely. And like you mentioned about, you know, somebody waving a six-figure check in front of you. I mean, first of all, putting aside the organized crime aspect, even under, you know, normal circumstances, you could easily burn through six figures in litigation here in the States, adding to that international courts. And, of course, we've been exposed to what some international courts look like with the Amanda Knox case and in Perugia and of course, the different elements of the legal system in various countries. So having to hire international attorneys that are familiar in those markets would have to be very expensive, and I imagine those six figures would rapidly disappear. And then, of course, when you're in a circumstance with organized crime, I imagine no amount of money is the correct amount of money to be able to do that. You know, moving along with all that in mind, and I think we all agree that proper planning and strategy is the correct way to go in looking at an international launch. But what, you know, if we look at this from the beginning, what internal and external resources will a franchisor need to develop or maybe even acquire for an international launch?
And that's a great question. I think the first thing that you need to look at is people. Without a doubt, you need a good international franchise attorney. Secondly, you need the foot soldiers to get out there and make it happen internationally. You've got to have at least start with a very seasoned international franchise executive. Now, that doesn't mean you need to hire one. I have seen some franchisors that have been very successful using a consultant, and consultants are quite effective. I've been in both roles, and sometimes a consultant is right for an organization. Sometimes a consultant isn't, and they want to hire that person in as an executive. What I think is that whoever that international person is, they have to be savvy about other markets. I mean, they need to take a holistic approach. They can't just be a sales guy. And I really stress that. I kind of joke around that, you know, during the first decade of my career in franchising, I was an operations support guy, then I got drawn over to the dark side of franchise development later on. But really, I think having that operations experience really helped me to be a better international franchise development executive. And, because it's not just about selling franchises. It's just like it's you know, that's where it's no different than the U.S. You know, if a franchisor is just worried about selling franchises but can't support their franchisees, they are going to build a house of cards. And that is very true with master franchisees. So, you know, you may have part of your team that is in-house, part of it that's outsourced to a consultant, but you do need that international experience. And, you know, it's my humble opinion that, you know, even the best U.S. Franchise executive, unless they have international experience, they're really not as capable of bringing a franchisor to market. So, you know, this is really, you know, people is, I think, the biggest resource. Secondly, you know, there's, you know, some things that you need in place. Probably the first thing you need to be looking at way ahead is you have to be able to ensure that your trademark is protected. The trademark, you know, the registration of trademarks can be very, very expensive, and but it's a critical part of your overall strategy. I think what's important is to evaluate what are your target markets, which countries are you really focused on, and you know you know you're going to go in. So let's say you know you're going to go into the UK, Germany, and Japan. You know you need to get your trademark registrations in process as quickly as possible. And this is one that is perhaps one of the toughest things to get in place because it takes time and it takes money. In the case of trademarks, it's become easier in Europe because you can essentially apply for a pan-European trademark. But in other countries, it can be much, much more tedious. And even for small countries, you know, it can be, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 to get a trademark registered. But it's an absolute must. So that's one of the things that needs to be in place really before you go abroad. And then country domain registrations. As soon as you go into India or go into Europe, you're going to find people hear about your company, and they're going to snap up those domain names. So, you know, if you are ABC Franchising, you're going to find that ABC.com works just fine, but ABC.co.uk for the UK may be taken. And so the quicker you can secure those, and it's, you know, it doesn't cost much at all. I mean, we're talking, you know, you can probably secure all of your trademarks for under $500. I'm sorry, not trademarks, your domain names. The issue really is are there squatters on your domain names already? And that is where it can get expensive because one franchisor that I was with was going into Australia, but unfortunately, the Australian domain was not secured, and there was a squatter sitting on it, and they basically said, "Look, we're not, you know, we don't need to give up this domain, and if you want it, it's going to cost you $20,000." So, you know, it's one thing that's commonly overlooked, but it happens quite frequently. So that's one thing that you really want to be sure you have in place. Another kind of item that needs to be there, of course, are your international agreements. This will go back to your overall strategy, but if you're going to be doing you know, a master franchise agreement, area developer agreements. You have to have those documents set up and ready to go, at least in a generic format. Each one will likely need to be adjusted for each country and perhaps even for each particular partner that you select. But, you know, I think those are some of the things that you need to have in place. And, of course, you know, you have to have a budget and, you know, and the organization ready to go. And you know, everyone needs to be on board with the international expansion program.
You know, it sounds like a very expensive proposition. And I know Joe probably has a question or two from the financial perspective. Joe, why don't you chime in here and share some of your inquisitive nature with respect to finances?
Okay, Paul. Well, you know, as a practical matter, Ray, why don't we talk budget for a minute? And what does it really cost for an international launch? And what are some of the budget items that a franchise or needs to consider as part of their plan?
Sure. I'd say I've done this from launch and budgeted and had P&L responsibility, so it's pretty, you know, it is something top of mind that I could kind of break down. You know, looking at the most costly elements, of course, you've got your personnel. So if you do hire a VP of international, you're going to have that headcount. And if you hire other international support people, you've got that cost. Again, that may be weighed against the advantages of perhaps starting out with an international consultant who can help guide you. The other big items really are going to be on legal. Legal, you're probably looking at least $100,000 in legal for the first year. Most of that is going to be spent on trademark registrations. The issue with with trademark registrations is you have to balance between which markets are mission critical and I've got to have the trademark, and which ones can we kind of wait until we're ready to pull the trigger and then, you know, get the trademark there, you know, before someone pulls the trademark from underneath us. Specific to that, however, the nice thing about trademarks is that, at least, you know, from a department perspective, that can be seen as a balance sheet item. It's still cash out. It's still going to cost you, you know, $100,000, depending on how many countries you want to register for. It can be significantly north of that. But the thing with the trademarks is that it is it goes on your balance sheet. It doesn't have as much of a revenue impact. Per se, or expense impact. the other items, as I've mentioned, the master franchise agreement, sub-franchise agreements, you're getting up into the, $100,000 to $200,000 range in legal. When you look at perhaps your second biggest budget item is marketing the opportunity, franchise development marketing. Really, if you're not committing, you know, if you're a serious player, if you're not committing $100,000 to it, you get what you pay for. If you're just looking for maybe one franchise agreement, two franchise agreements in the first year, yeah, you could probably do that with a marketing budget under $100,000. But if if you want to hit it and hit it in a real way, you're probably going to need, you know, at least 100K. Travel and entertainment, again, usually that is close to whatever the franchise development budget is. There is a correlation there because a lot of times the travel will be to international shows, traveling to meet with international candidates in-country, so on and so forth. And then you have, you know, the other areas would be, which I kind of call franchise support projects. And, you know, you might want to dedicate, I don't know, maybe about $50,000 towards this, maybe $100,000, depending on the complexity of your franchise business model. So, for example, if you are a training franchise and you have your proprietary training materials, those are going to need to be localized. Well, first they're going to need to be internationalized, and then they're going to need to be localized. And I'll explain that in a second. If you have software, you're going to have to ensure that if that software is mission critical to the operation, you're going to have to ensure that you have some type of international version of that software that will work in the UK, that will work in, you know, across several countries. As an example, you know, perhaps your management software for each of your franchisees has an accounting element to it. Well, accounting is done completely differently in the UK. Even though you think it's English speaking, we can just transfer it over. Well, you know, you get into VAT taxes and other small things that really throw a monkey wrench into the software equation. So you may have to go back and redesign or have your vendor tweak those softwares in order for them to work in Europe and Asia, et cetera. and I've mentioned two words in terms of your support tools and systems. One is internationalization, one is localization. generally speaking, the franchisor is not responsible for all of the localization. And what I mean by that is the franchisor needs to provide something that can be localized. So that is something that I call internationalization. So if you have, for example, a television ad that is critical to a program you're rolling out globally, well, that ad needs to be formatted in a way that it can easily be translated into Spanish, into Japanese, or, you know, whatever, and has to be, you know, looked at from a global perspective, so that it's not being culturally insensitive or whatever. That's what I mean by providing an internationalized tool or product. Then, generally speaking, it is up to that master franchisee to localize it. So if they decide that the ad's too long, they'll need to edit it down. And if they decided, you know, that they need it in Spanish, they do the voiceover in Spanish. If the Brits don't like the American accent, then they can voice it over with a British accent. So I kind of look at those two things as separate elements, but it behooves the franchisor to be involved in the internationalization of their business model, because that helps to control the brand image and really helps to provide a more consistent approach to, especially to marketing and operations and software outside of the U.S. So kind of a long story on that line item, but I would certainly budget some money for project internationalization. And then finally, there's one item that I recommend that new to international franchisors put in there. In a rough sense, probably you want to put $50,000 to $100,000 into what I call U.S. headquarter allocation. And the idea behind that is to realize that in the early stages, you're going to be pulling from other departments. So you'll be pulling from the marketing department. Maybe you'll need a technical trainer that goes over for the first launch of the first few master franchisees. Maybe you're going to have to use some resources of the ad agency. So the marketing department is going to need to incur more expenses there. Really, what I like to see is that there's an allocation for international on everyone's P&L, and the international is able to contribute to those departments and to be able to say, hey, look, this is a priority for me. We're paying for it. We're paying you as a department. Let's get this done. I found that works internally just to build, a more healthy, collaborative type of a project launch for international. I'd say those are the different elements. You add all that up, and I don't know, you're probably talking about, expenses of $500,000 to $750,000, to get it out of the ground.
Well, that definitely wipes out that small six-figure check. Shifting gears a little bit, and as we know, there are various development models, single country, multi country master franchise agreements, area development where the area developer owns and operates all units and doesn't sub franchise, etc. So, what are the pros and cons of the various franchise development models?
Right. That's a great question, and it's one that every franchisor needs to evaluate. It is my opinion that there is no single approach for most franchisors. Some franchisors may do very well with only doing a master franchise agreement internationally. And that's generally the belief. Let's just do master franchising, and that's the model we're going to use. However, I would suggest that there may be situations in which, based on the market, the size, the demographics, the wealth in the market, based on the franchise partner, based on what their capital resources are, how much experience they have in franchising, and then finally, based on the franchisor's desire to have control. So, for example, if you want to go into Canada and you want to have significant control over what's going on in Canada or in the UK or in Australia, that may change the approach that you take. There are lots of pros and cons, and I could spend another hour on those for the different models. But what as an example, I had a change of heart on this because one time I recruited two master franchisees. Neither of them had franchising experience, but they had experience in the industry. Well, it turned out that they started looking at this about 2 years into it. They said, this doesn't make sense for us. We're not really franchisors. We've got enough capital just to do this ourselves, and we'll make a lot more money doing that. So why don't we change our agreement? And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, those master franchisees became essentially area development franchises where they owned all units in their territory. So, you know, it's something that should be thought through. It should be discussed with the master franchisee or the area developer candidate. And, you know, you do your best to try to make the best match for your franchise concept. I would say, however, you know, it's good to be open to change. And, you know, as situations change, maybe you do want to switch between being a master franchisee and being an area developer. So it's just something that I think a lot of franchisors haven't considered. They feel that they have to pick one or the other. And certainly that's not true on a country-by-country basis. And I would also argue that it could be true over the life of the partnership that you could actually change between an area development agreement and a master franchise. The area development, what you're going to find is there's a lot of different definitions internationally for that. Some are, you know, they own and operate all units and don't sub-franchise. You know, some, you know, they do actually go out and recruit sub-franchises, but, you know, the franchise agreement is direct with the parent franchisor. So there are so many different models out there. But I believe if you have two or three that could make sense with your concept, you should be willing to evaluate what's the best fit for the market and for the franchise partner that you're working with.
You know, it seems like, I mean, the cultural aspects have to come into play from a variety of reasons. I mean, obviously from a consumer standpoint, but also the cultural aspect of being in a quote-unquote partnership with, you know, a businessman from that country. I mean, the cultural aspects really have to be investigated.
Yeah, absolutely. Culture, especially company culture, is critical. I mean, I obviously, you would assume you're going to run into, you know, the differences in international cultures, but you need to also be sure that your companies match up nicely. You know, everyone can point to, for example, the Daimler-Chrysler merger, which was a total disaster. And part of it was the difference between the German management style and the American management style. But, you know, it wasn't all international. It was just corporate culture differences. And I've seen this happen before with U.S. franchisors and master franchisees, and it usually does not end well. So this is where doing your due diligence up front is mission critical. You've just got to be sure this is the right partner, you're on the same page, you've set the correct expectations, and that, you know, that this is something that will last for the long haul. So on the company culture, I think that's key. International culture, cross-cultural communications, is also important. You need to have that advocate within your organization who can, you know, sit down with senior executives and say, hey, look, we can't do this way in Germany because of A, B, and C. You know, it just doesn't look good, and, you know, we're going to get them, you know, pretty ticked off with us if we do this. Also, you need as much in-person contact as you can. So, of course, you know, U.S. franchisors expect that the franchisee is going to get on a plane and fly over to visit the U.S. headquarters, but that has to go the other way, too. Every once in a while, you've got to get your senior management and other managers really out into the field meeting with the international franchise partners in their market. And part of that is for them to understand the reality on the ground. because they may have a completely different conception of what India is like. So when they get there, it kind of hits them, you know, like a thunderclap. Yeah, this is a different world. So I think that helps a lot. Another thing that I encourage is training your U.S. headquarters staff. The ones who would have the most interaction with master franchisees or their manager. So the training staff, the franchise development staff, who, you know, if they come in for a discovery day, whoever's going to be meeting with those individuals from abroad, they need to have some sense of cross-cultural communication etiquette. And so one of the things I always enjoyed doing was I'd buy lunch for, you know, that team of people, you know, and it may be, I don't know, 20, 30 people, and we'd have a lunch and learn. And, you know, of course, that lunch and learn might be tied to, you know, the fact that this person was from Singapore and here's some neat things about Singapore. You know, here's, you know, do's and don't do's. You know, here's how you hold your business card. Here's what you can expect. You know, so, and you do it not only it's not just a training opportunity. It's an opportunity to motivate the other people, the other departments, to be on board with international. And what you'll find is that the other employees within the headquarters start to really enjoy the challenge of international and get into it, instead of it being seen as, you know, this very scary thing that, you know, I don't know what to do when I don't understand what this guy's asking me, you know.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So that becomes important, and I think, again, just the more interaction that you have between the organizations and the people, the better. And the cultural issues will usually work themselves out.
Well, Ray, I certainly would look forward to having you on the show again, as I still have a list of questions that I'd love to ask you. Unfortunately, we only have an hour, so we'll definitely circle back with you and try to get you on the show, because I know, you know, some of the questions regarding, you know, franchise recruiting in the international markets and some of the things that are very important that our listeners are interested in, we'll have to discuss. But again, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day and being a guest on Franchise Today.
Well, thank you for that, for the opportunity, and I would very much enjoy that, the opportunity to come back and talk and share more war stories. And for your listeners out there who want to know more about me, I do have a blog. It's Ray Hayes, and that is spelled R-A-Y-H-A-Y-S, so no E in Hayes, rayhayes.com. And I sometimes put out some articles and interesting tidbits on international franchising. So, but
well,
again,
great.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's great, because what I'd like to do is circle back with you and also have you do a guest post on the Franchise Essentials blog site as well. That would be great.
Absolutely. I would certainly be it would be a pleasure to do it. And again, thanks for this opportunity. It's been a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Well, Joe, that was another great show. We're inside the 92nd mark. I certainly could relate to a lot of what Ray said, even though I haven't been in the international waters as of yet. Having worked with two principals of Korean and Indian descent in my first stint as an officer with a franchise company, I could only imagine what it must be like across borders.
It can be challenging. I was vice president at two different companies where we had international operations, and I had both sales and operations on the international level. And it's never fun to have to do things like get on a plane and go collect money because somebody
right.
can't get to you. But in any event, while we were on the show, we got confirmation from Michael Webster, franchise attorney out of Toronto, that he's going to do a recap on November 3rd of the American Bar Association Forum on Franchising. So that's some great news that commitment came in via email just a few minutes ago.
Well, that's great. Well, next week we'll be talking about FranCamp, and I'll be speaking at the event in Saturday the 21st. Until then, actually, I just got confirmation from somebody from FranCamp. I did not get confirmation. It's just a question. I apologize. Well, anyway, until next week, Paul Segretto wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. And Franchise Today is out.